The 100 Years' War, the Gisclin Period, France Turns Against Flanders, Part 1. The opinion of the French Royal Council was now rapidly turning against the Flemings. Between the 5th and the 10th of October, 1382, the king left Montargis and headed north. At some stage, reports must have reached him of the proceedings at Westminster, where the English government had been quite open about the state of their negotiations with Philip van Artevelde. In the middle of October, the court reached Compiègne, north of Paris. There they received Philip van Artevelde's intemperate letters. This time there appears to have been little of any argument in the council. The attack on Aquitaine was cancelled. The assembly of the army was moved from Orléans to Peron and Corbeil in the northern Picardy, and fixed for the end of October. In order to block the passage of troops from England, a subsidiary force was sent through Thironin and the wedge of territory between the Pale of Calais and the Ditch of Aa, which marked the western extremity of Flanders. From the siege lines at Oudenarde, Philip van Artevelde breathed defiance. Writing to the councillors who had been at Tournai, he declared that there would never be peace in Flanders while the count tried to strangle the commerce of Ghent by maintaining his fortresses on the Scheldt. If the French army invaded, the Flemings would defeat them as they had done before. Van Artevelde was thinking, as perhaps others were, of 1302, the Annus Mirabilis of Flemish endeavors, where the great towns had destroyed the chivalry of France at the Battle of Courtrai. The ambassadors of the three great towns of Flanders arrived at Westminster about October the 25th, 1382. They received a warm welcome on the streets of London, where the support for Ghent was running high. The politicians were more equivocal. The common support for the path of Flanders had shifted opinion within the council and fortified the opponents of the path of Portugal. But John of Gaunt was fighting a rearguard action with the support of his brothers and a number of other magnates. The Flemings, who seem to have been largely unconscious of these two divisions, were received by the council shortly after their arrival. Two of the king's uncles, Lancaster and Buckingham, were present, together with the earls of Salisbury and Kent, Simon Burley and the steward of the royal household, John Montague, as well as a number of other councillors. It must have been a difficult meeting for John of Gaunt, but his position was eased by the extravagant demands which Philip van Artevelde had instructed the ambassadors to make. The councillors were taken aback by the suggestion that England should pay £140,000 for the privilege of sending military assistance to Flanders. They began to smile as the ambassador's message was being read out. When the Flemings left the room, they burst out laughing. Early in November, the Flemings were escorted to Dover. They took with them another draft treaty for submission to the captain of Ghent without offering provisions. They got no further than Calais. When they reached the English enclave, they found their route home was already blocked by the French army assembling in the March of Flanders. Charles VI arrived with his entourage at Arras on November 1, 1382, and installed himself in the monastery of St. Nicholas, beyond the northern suburbs of the town. There he received Louis de Mauve, who performed the act of homage which this proud man had not proffered to the King of France for 30 years. The king was only 14 years old, but like Richard II in England, he was already more than a richly dressed doll who presided at council meetings, mouthing assent to his tutor's summary decisions. In the course of a brief childhood dominated by rituals and symbols of military life, Charles had learned to love the trappings of war. He was fascinated by armor and weaponry, obsessed with jousts and tournaments. A miniature suit of chainmail was made for him every year as he grew, with a steel helmet enameled with the gold fleur-de-lis. It was characteristic of him that he had insisted, in the spite of objections from some of his council, on taking part personally in the campaign against the Flemings. Quote, "If I am the reign in power and glory," he said, "I must learn the profession of arms," end of quote. Charles had been too young at his father's death to have experienced the frustrations of a subordinate position at the royal court. Like most infant kings, he had been brought up to the exalted idea of the royal majesty, which could be uncomfortable for the experienced commanders and administrators who governed in his name. It could also generate intense, uncompromising anger against rebellious subjects, whose lives and motives he knew almost nothing. In the south of Arras, the marshal's officers were beginning to take muster of the largest army to assemble in France since 1356. It was a remarkable feat of military logistics. Companies of men-at-arms continued to arrive during the first 3 weeks of November, bringing an effective strength to nearly 10,000 men. They came from every part of France. The Duke of Burgundy, the strongest proponent and main beneficiary of the campaign, contributed more than a fifth of the army from territory of his duchy and from his retainers amongst the French nobility. He had taxed his subjects, borrowed heavily from moneylenders, and melted down his gold and silver plate to pay for their wages. Of the whole force, 6,500 were men-at-arms, with more than 2,000 pikemen, 1,200 archers and crossbowmen. To the north at Lille, a second smaller army was being assembled by the officers of Louis de Mal from the French-speaking castleries in southern Flanders and the ranks of the exiled nobility of the country, as well as from his allies amongst the neighboring principalities of the Low Countries. They were above all cavalry armies recruited from the nobility. The anger and fear provoked amongst these men by the defiance of Ghent had proved to be a powerful recruiting agent. Although the king's council had drawn on selected towns for infantry and bowmen, their numbers were kept to a minimum. They were uncomfortably aware of the hostility of the whole enterprise in the cities of northern France, where there is strong fellow feeling for the men of Ghent. The stories of some of the men arriving at muster bore out their concerns. In the village of Attiché, near Compiègne, the local lord's demand for the traditional cart and team to take equipment to the army was obstructed by local men who protested that the men of Ghent were no enemies of the king, but allies of Paris and Rouen. The company of the Marshal of Burgundy was attacked by a mob as it passed through Reims, on the way to join the army and prevented from going further. The arrival during the autumn of commissioners charged with exacting supplementary aids aggravated the grief of the men like this. In Paris, now denuded of troops, tension was running high. Leagues were being formed in every quarter to organize resistance to the collectors. Plans were laid to take over streets and kill the king's officers. Spies reported plots to storm the Louvre and the castle of Vincennes. Quote, wait and see how the king fares at Flanders, end of quote, said Nicholas Flemick, an old conspirator who had been a ringleader of the lynch mobs of 1358. If Ghent prevails, as we all hope, then will be the time to rise. So we're going to move against the Flemings, but the local people back in France hope the French lose, and if they do, they'll revolt again. So we'll see what takes place next time. Now the sources for this, The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.